Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Jake Gibb. You're in the net live.
This is Taiba Hanif Park, and you are in the net live.
Aloha, this is Mike Lambert, and you are in the net live.
Loy Ball, and you're on the net live.
Ryan Malone, and you're in the net live.
Hey, this is Heather Ballin, and you're live in the net. Nope, that was totally wrong.
Hey, this is Karch Gira, and you're in the net live with Willie and Barney.
It's Monday. It's the Net Live here on the VolleyballNetwork.com. I'm Kevin Barnett. I'm here hosting the show, sitting in the home court live in Redondo Beach, trying to hold it all together. You hear it ringing now. We're trying to get Reed Pretty back once again from Russia, from his hotel room. Reed,
what's happening?
You're here with us for the moment. That's a good thing.
That was quick. I mean, I think I just got to, hey, this is Jake Gibb, and you're in the net live, and then I'm out.
Yeah. You're setting new records for departing the show. Just let me know when it's starting to fade. I'll put on some music, and we can play you right off, as usual.
I'm just happy to hear that Karch is still a part of the introduction. We might not be able to get him for the show, but at least he's in the introduction.
Yeah. I think we may actually be hearing from his lawyer eventually that we have to edit him out of our introduction because he's upset with us in our critique of the Corona Wide Open and various other things he's involved with. Well, hey, we're glad you tuned in here to the Net Live. It is the 22nd of November. We are the pre-Thanksgiving show. We hope everyone's going to have a safe week, get back and visit with some family, maybe even play a little bit of volleyball, depending upon where you are in the United States. We're looking forward to another good show here today. We're missing Geeter. He's expected to call in at some point during the program, but he will be back. I think he's finalizing his schedule and finally making the Net Live a priority, so we're expecting to have him in the home court quite a bit more often between now and Christmas. Should be a lot of fun. Reed is, of course, hanging on from Russia as long as his internet connection lasts. And I'm here with the cat, Mr. Bigglesworth, sitting in my lap, hanging out in the sun, as usual, on the home court. This week we've got a lot of good stuff coming up. Got two great guests, Steve Shondell, head coach of Ball State's women's program, and also Mark Rosen of Michigan. Both of those coaches are going to join us to talk about their programs as the season comes to an end. We've got a lot of news from around the world of volleyball. Brandon Rosenthal is going to call in and co-host for a while today since he's got a lot of college knowledge. And we know Reed is just following the Russian college scene, not really following the American college scene quite as closely. So he'll be calling in. They're coming off his team. Lipscomb is coming off of another Atlantic Sun championship with our own Alex Kelly, intern Alex, named MVP of the tournament.
Nice.
Yeah. So we're going to talk to her. We're going to talk to Brandon. He's going to be a good addition to the show as usual. AVP filing bankruptcy. We'll have some talk about that. The NCAA tournament is starting to take shape. We've got bubble teams. We've got teams that are qualified. We'll go through that. We'll have the College Volleyball Weekly as normal, talking about the matchups that are left. A lot of teams with two games to go or less here in this final week. Selection show coming up next Sunday, so we'll talk about all those issues surrounding that. And a little news here at home, Philadelphia Eagles, if they keep playing the way they are, we're talking Eagles in the Super Bowl, and I will go to the Super Bowl if the Eagles are in it. I will find a ticket. I will somehow become a member of the Super Bowl club. That's my
look, hands down, all I have to say is that Michael Vick is the best player to ever suit up.
In any position?
At any position, just put him out there and he's going to win the game. That's all I keep hearing about on every single sports outlet, sports news outlet. They just are gushing over Michael Vick. And yes, I did see the performance against the Redskins and it was amazing. But goodness gracious, I like how he's trying to calm things down in his own press conferences. But
yeah,
a lot of gushing going on.
Yeah, a lot of adoration for just the way he played. I don't think we've ever seen anyone take over a football game the way that he took over that game on Monday night against the Redskins. I think Vince Young in the 05 Rose Bowl is the only other comparable performance that we've seen. And this brought up a question for me relating into volleyball. and we'll have to do a little bit more research on this, and our viewers can let us know who's the best athlete to have ever played college volleyball or professional volleyball in the United States, both men and women. Give me the best female athlete, the best male athlete in the United States ever to have played. And this isn't most successful, so I don't want to hear about this guy won this many championships, these medals, all those other things. I'm talking about just raw athleticism. Let's talk about the best athlete to have ever played. I don't care what his results were, but someone that achieved a college or a professional level, and you think that they're the most superior athlete. So that's going to be a discussion for another day, because what Michael Vick is doing is remarkable now in that he's a great player of the game, where he's not just a great athlete. He's kind of put both those things together, but I think he's got to be one of the most remarkable athletes ever to put on a uniform in the world of sports.
I think you're right, but I think it's a little early to say he's the best player of all time. Maybe everyone's just kind of reaching for storylines at the same time, but his performances have definitely been impressive.
That's why I say the best player of all time and the best athlete of all time are different people. Definitely different people.
Yeah. So when you say an athlete, is this how do we need to think about that question? Are we talking, is this somebody that could play at a high level many different sports, or biggest, fastest, strongest?
Within the sport, like freakish athlete within the sport. The results don't matter to a point. I mean, obviously, if somebody played like one college match, that's not going to cut it. But I'm not talking about he has to have a medal, he has to have a championship, he has to have players of the year, whatever else it happens to be. It has to be some sort of name somebody's going to recognize. Don't tell me about somebody from Topeka who one time jumped 60 inches and spiked the ball straight down in your backyard on your grandmother. Not looking for that, but we need somebody. Well, think about those. Who's in that conversation? George Romaine comes to mind. I think he's in that conversation. Just a freakish athlete. You're talking 6'8", touch 12 feet. Could probably run a 4.5 40. It's just somebody like that. Are there other people out there like that?
I think of Danny. I think of Danny Farmer comes to mind. A guy that won a national championship in volleyball and also played in the NFL. Maybe even Destiny Hooker,
is in that conversation. Yep.
Many think that she could be a professional track star as well.
Yeah. Is it a Flo Hyman? Is it somebody from way back when? Obviously very successful, but also could be freakish athlete. So it shouldn't be just success, although it could be someone that had great success. Hey, Reed, last week's show was a good one. We talked to James Lights of IMG on his deal with USA Volleyball. We talked to Mike O'Hara, and we talked to Alex Kleiman. Now, you had an opportunity to listen to the show. What kind of reaction did you have to any one of those interviews?
Mike O'Hara had some great things to say, obviously, and I am looking forward to reading his book. And he makes an interesting point about volleyball needing to always have television in mind, that's really what's going to push things forward on a professional level. And that's the conundrum that volleyball finds itself in. You know, we have to pay at such an enormous amount of money just to get one match on TV every weekend.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of, we're kind of stuck in this middle zone. And so I like the discussions that we had both last week and in previous shows, just about the concept of media going online and the opportunities there are to possibly live stream. And I wonder what if we weren't on TV for a couple years? What if we spent all that money that it took to take one, to broadcast one match on network TV? What if we put all of those resources into building a media team that live streamed the event from Thursday to Sunday and carried about 8 to 10 hours of programming daily? I wonder if we would be able to put together a package that would be attractive and really begin to allow the fans that sort of access that we're talking about.
You're talking about developing your own plan external to the networks to then make it perhaps appealing later to the networks after you've built the property that they would want to get involved with rather than just getting on air and paying the fees today.
Correct. Correct. And, there's obviously the sponsors want to be on network TV, but at the same time, I don't know. I'm not a professional in any sense, but with the advent of TiVo and DVRs, people aren't really watching a ton of commercials anyway.
Yeah.
And so if there was on-air ads and there was a mix zone with sponsor signage in the background and things of that nature, I really feel like the experience from the fan would be so heightened, and I think there would be such a buzz stimulated. But to be honest with you, from James's interview, even when I I listened to it the second time. It really sounds like the same model. It doesn't sound like a difference in model. And I hope we can have him on again just to maybe ask the questions. You know, when we talk about – when we talk to the Jason Hodels, the Holly McPeaks, and the Mike Dodds, they're telling us that, hey, we need a model change. And back in the day when TV had some horse in the race and the players were part owners, does that play into what IMG and USAV – VB are setting out to do, or is this another 80% operational cost, 20% prize money player model?
No, absolutely not. It's not going to have that giant overhead, and that's one of the comments I've heard from a lot of different sources. I've talked to people at the top of this thing, and one of the big comments has been, when you hear about it, is that it's not going to be that model where 80% of the money is sucked up by salaries to the five guys at the top. It's not going to be that. You have to shed some of that stuff, and that's going to be, I think, one of the major model changes you're going to see, is that it is going to be more of a complete package for an organization, part of an organization, rather than a standalone business for one guy or two guys and his five buddies. So I think they're going to take that part off the top. And, I Leitz's experience with it was, by the way, we call him James Leitz, both times during the interview, or three times during the interview. His name is James Leitz. We'll need to find that out later. But one of the things I like about his experience is the U.S. Open of Surfing. And we keep making this surfing comparison. I've argued against it before, but I think from an organizational standpoint, from an event standpoint, here's something that is live streaming on the internet, doesn't have coverage on regular television. So I think Leitz's experience with that will go towards what you're talking about, Reed, and telling that whole story and building a product that doesn't necessarily depend on that time buy from an ESPN, ABC, or an NBC situation. And you may be able to take a huge component out there, although they still need some TV coverage. They're going to have to find a partner somehow. It's this chicken the egg with sponsors.
Yeah, I get it, though. But, I mean, by his own admission, what they're selling is not a product. What they're selling is a lifestyle. And that's really hard to – I mean, that's abstract.
I don't wear out a lifestyle.
You know, I buy a lifestyle.
I buy a lifestyle. You know, I don't have to go spend $15 on a new lifestyle every 2 years.
I mean, if we could bottle it up and sell it, then, I mean, I would like the Phil Dahlhauser lifestyle. Actually, I would like the Misty May lifestyle and Dancing with the Stars, but we can't bottle it up and sell it.
Speaking of Todd and Phil, Scott Perkins on our Facebook page had a great comment. He was talking about the interview with James Leitz, and he said, "Sounds like they have a nut of just under $10 million for the tour. However, the number one question wasn't answered. If Todd and Phil aren't on board with the tour has about as much chance as Sonny Corleone at a toll booth." That was that comment. But I think the one thing you're forgetting in this, Scott, is that if the money is there, if the prize money is there, the $150K or $100K or whatever, if some reasonable amount of prize money is there, the players will come. The players will play. The question is what they will show up for. How much money can you buy them for? And that's kind of been the debate with Carrie Walsh and her argument against the Corona Wide Open or against the U.S. Open, the Manhattan Beach event this past year after the AVP collapse, is that she doesn't want herself and other professional volleyball players being bought for less than a certain number of prize money, whether it's $100K, $150K, whatever it is. So as long as USA Volleyball and IMG are able to provide a number that makes sense to the players, they'll show up. It doesn't matter who's running the tournament. These guys are mercenaries. You're talking about making a living playing volleyball. If there's a bunch of money on the line, they'll show up. It doesn't matter the tournament structure. Because I got news for you. If there was a $200,000 tournament and it was played old school scoring, you would see Kerry Walsh and some other people show up. It wouldn't all of a sudden be about this principle of the scoring. I think it all comes down to the money.
I think you're right, and I think it's a bummer that it is such – you're right. Mercenary is the right way to describe the way professional volleyball is, and it, even on the indoor side, it's a shame. I've been racking my brain and trying to bounce a bunch of stuff off here about how to change that direction, whether it be indoor or beach, to where it's not such a selfish environment of I got to make everything I can make right now. How do we bind together and build – something that that when, you know, Phil and Todd, or let's say Todd, he's close to retirement, when he retires, it's not your insurance is cut the second you retire and you no longer have an ability to make money along those lines. And I guess that's my biggest push, is I continue to say the players have to unite, the players have to unite. It's not so much for the sake of forming a union, because I could name about five of the biggest unions in America that I personally don't agree with. I don't think they're healthy or good. But I really believe that the players are part of the equation. I would love to see management and players be in this together, that it not be one side or the other, but they say, hey, we're in business together. It's going to work best for us to mutually understand that and buy in together.
I think the only way the players aren't mercenaries is if they're bound together in some sort of union, and then you negotiate with the union. I don't think they need any ownership of what's happening. I think you can keep the business part separate from the players. Players play and players complain. That's what they're good at. They're not really good at much else as a whole. There's certain exceptions, but I think they should bind together in their own organization and have sanctioned tournaments and function under their own umbrella that then license tournaments or sanctions tournaments with USA Volleyball, the FIVB, whoever it is. Could be any other operator. Could be a separate operator like Cincinnati or Milwaukee. You can have that, and I think that that's where the players need to organize themselves. They need to keep their nose out of the rest of the business. You listen to Hans talk about how he doesn't like the fact that the tour operator needs to make money. Well, Hans, the world's about making money. So that person has to make money. If you're going to get involved with this, that person is going to have to make money at some point. And we've talked about the Philip Anschutz model and having a billionaire get interested in volleyball and be willing to lose money. But even Anschutz is looking forward and saying, if I build this property, I'll eventually make my money back. But in the midterm, I'm willing to lose $100, $150 million. That's really what it's going to take to push the sport to the next level.
Yeah, I don't even think it necessarily – I necessarily mean that they have actual ownership. I think of when I was waiting tables at a restaurant, the particular family that was running this restaurant, even though the majority of us were in our later teens, early 20s, they had a way of making us feel like we were a part of the bigger picture. And I tell you, we were motivated as a group to be the best restaurant possible. We weren't just there to clock in, clock out. And it wasn't just about earning as much as we could that particular day. And the way things are set up, even on the indoor side, Kevin, I know you know this from USA Volleyball. I mean, there's some players that won a gold medal one day and 2 days later are given notice that their insurance is cut, and that's it. And it's, yeah. It creates an environment to where the players have to fight for every single penny, as opposed to being a part of a program and a system that's trying to put you out there in your own city, in your own town, trying to promote you as much as possible to try to set up some sort of coaching gig or appearance fees or whatever. It creates a system. And it's hard to go to the players like a Todd and a Phil and say, hey, you need to make decisions based on the good of the majority when nobody's looking out for them. It's a tough.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep up on the story. It's not over yet. It'll continue developing. We're definitely going to talk to Dave Williams. He'll be coming on the show December 13th. We haven't planned for. He'll be coming on to give us an update of what's happening and talk about the USA Volleyball side of things, as he is the director of Beach for USA Volleyball. I've had conversations with Doug Beal, CEO of USA Volleyball. I'll continue talking to him and getting information for you, our listeners, about the impending Beach situation for 2011. But I think we've spent enough time on that. I want to get to a product review. We've been testing a few products here and in the home court and with the kids and stuff. If you have a product out there, a volleyball-related product you want us to give a shot at and give a review of, by all means, contact us, thenetlive@gmail.com, and we'll give it a look. But Mikasa's been a big supporter of the show. Jordan over at Mikasa sent us out a press release about a thing called a bump board a few weeks ago. And I said, hey, Jordan, you got to send one of those over to the show here. We'll give it a shot. I got the boys. Break out the balls, break out the bump board, and he sent one over. Great little product. It's basically a wide platform that goes on your forearms with a little cushioning underneath, straps onto one arm. And my boys love this thing. It's designed to help kids learn to pass without hurting their arms and kind of giving them that wider platform to have more success passing the ball and really get the feel for how to do it before they start pounding on their forearms and that narrow little section that their forearms is, especially my skinny little monkeys. They don't have much of a platform to work with. It's like working with the narrow bat when you're playing wiffle ball. So we put this thing on them, and they're bumping the ball back and forth. Really fun. unsolicited quote from my son Max, my six-year-old, while we're playing with it, just offhand, while we're in the middle of playing, he goes, "I love the bump board." Which I thought was great. It's awesome to get kids into volleyball. So I think the positives for this product, the bump board in particular, is it's light, it's durable. This thing, you could beat the heck out of it. It's not going to break. It's going to scratch, but it's not going to break in half. And it helps kids learn to pass without destroying their forearms. The one negative I had on this thing, and I talked to Jordan about it, was the graphics on the board. They have a logo and kind of a Japanese rising sun type thing going on there. The logo is set down towards the wrists, and that looks like the impact point is set down towards the wrists of this bump board, when really it ought to be right in the middle of the thing so it would hit you on the forearms. I'd like to see them change those graphics, and I know Jordan said that was a point of great debate within Mikasa when they were developing this thing, but I think they need to move that graphic package up so they have kids passing in the right spot. Bottom line for this product, would we recommend it to you, the listeners? If you're teaching young kids how to pass, you're talking 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, learning to pass, first introduction to volleyball, should you get some bump boards and use them? I'd say yes. Definitely get a couple of bump boards. They're awesome. Go to MikasaSports.com. You can buy them right off of there. I think they even have a free shipping promotion going right now they were telling me about. So get out there, MikasaSports.com. Check out the bump board. I like it a lot. We've got a future product review coming, Zamps, which is a Japanese corporation, makes a lot of athletic braces, icing packages, and that kind of thing. I've got a couple of knee braces, a back brace, an ice kit. We're going to have a review coming for them, but we're testing their products also. So we've got some more stuff in the hopper to tell you about. Really nice stuff. I rode this past week a little motocross and wore some of the Zamp stuff. So far, good stuff with it. I really like it.
What does a guy got to do to get some product to test out? I mean, I reached out to him too, Kevin, and I mean, I'm the one playing still.
Well, you have to have, the right connections. You have to be nice. You have to.
Kevin Barnett's show. You're getting all the stuff, I guess. Jeez.
Yeah, and that's not even talking about the gold bullion that I'm testing out for the Fed. And
he ripped it last night.
Well, hey, I want to show now. I think you can already hear Alex Kelly. I can't shoot her off the switchboard here. But I want to bring into the show.
What's that?
An old friend, Brandon Rosenthal, head coach of Lipscomb University, coming off, the third straight championship, fourth straight appearance in the final match for the Atlantic Sun Championship?
I like you just giving me more championships. It's actually the second straight, but third and fourth year. Four years.
Okay, third and 4 years. You're coming off a championship where you guys were down 0-2 as I was watching on the Facebook updates. And it seemed like everything was coming to an end.
You know what? It was a little unfamiliar. We haven't really been down 0-2 in a couple of years, to be honest with you. And I give the credit to the girls. They kind of hung tough and really showed what they're all about. The other team, ETSU, East Tennessee State, did a real nice job and really kind of. The only way I could put it is really punched us in the mouth, right from the get go and. We struggled a little bit to, gather our composure. But in the end, we got some pretty experienced girls. And, one of them is intern Alex, who just took over and really showed, why she is an All-American. And pretty proud of her and the rest of the team just for, a well-fought battle.
You have the Conference Player of the Year in your setter, Jake Peasy, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you have Alex
Jake Pease,
who pulled down the MVP of the tournament. So you have the two best players in the conference. What do you really have to do as a coach? I mean, you just roll the balls out?
get them to the gym, basically. No, you know what? They're we were pretty calm, in between 2 and 3. And, they've done a great job of leading this team for the past 4 years. And, it was really just getting them to understand kind of the task at hand. And, for us, I'd asked them, how many times we'd won 3-0, and, they all answered, a lot. And I said, we can't look at this as being down 0-2. We just got to look at it as being a brand-new match. and, you know, 0-0. And I thought if there was a way we could come out in the third and grab a 2 or 3 point lead, I thought we'd be perfectly fine. And credit goes to Jake and Alex. I mean, as a coach, it's kind of one of those things where, you know, I kind of give them the framework and, you know, they take it and ran with it. And they've done that over their four-year career. So it is, you know, from a coaching standpoint, it's a blessing to have, you know, two such, you know, quality individuals on the court, but also leadership-wise, too, to, you know, take over when, you know, it really matters.
I like the way you framed it to me when we were talking this weekend after it was over, saying that you're down 0-2 and you said to the team, we've won 3-0 plenty of times. And that's all this is an opportunity to win 3-0. I think that's a great way to look at being down 0-2, especially in a situation where you feel like you're the superior team and ought to be having more success than you're having in a match. Really a good coaching point.
Yeah, you know, I think you guys have had this before. I mean, it was just a matter we really hadn't played our kind of brand of volleyball yet, and you know, my comment to our assistant coach Samantha Sullivan was, hey, if we're going to lose, then I want us losing our, you know, playing our brand of volleyball. And so that was kind of all of that we said was, hey, look, let's just go out and play the way we know how to play and let the, you know, chips fall. And you know, like I said, it was interesting, and you know, I think we gave our fans a little bit of a heart attack, but the girls did a real nice job.
Well, hey, we want to talk to intern Alex, but give us a couple minutes here. We're going to take a little commercial break here on the Net Live.
Yeah, no worries.
You're listening to Net Live on the VolleyballNetwork.com. We still have Mark Rosen, a Michigan head coach, Steve Shondell from Ball State, the College Volleyball Weekly, and Reed's still hanging on for Russia. This has got to be a time record, man. Let's see if we can keep for the whole show. Brandon, myself, and Reed will be right back. The Net Live. Hey parents, do you know about the USYVL, the United States Youth Volleyball League? Having taught over 100,000 kids ages 7 to 15 the sport of volleyball, the league's proven techniques, super fun approach, and self-esteem lifting methods are unmatched. Truly, volleyball starts here. For more information about the league and programs in your area, visit usyvl.org. That's usyvl.org.
Hey, Reed.
Yeah, Dan.
Hey, if I wanted to call in and talk to you guys, what would I have to do?
Well, first you'd have to have something meaningful to say.
I can do that.
And then you want to probably scale that down to about 20 seconds.
Done.
And then you want to pick up the phone and dial 347-677-1525.
So I can call 347-677-1525 and say, Reed Pretty, you're my favorite volleyball player ever.
Now, Dan, when you say that, are you making fun of me? Or, is the joke on me? I don't get it.
Get off the bench, sub yourself in, pick up the phone and call.
The Net Live will not be held responsible for opinions and ideas expressed by others.
Welcome back. The Net Live here on the VolleyballNetwork.com. As always, live from the Redondo Beach home court here in sunny Southern California. Back being nice here. It's been rainy over the weekend, but another beautiful day coming up. Sky is clear, and we are excited to be talking volleyball with you here on the Net Live. We hope that you're getting this broadcast live as often as possible. If you want to call in and talk to us, 347-677-1525. give us a call. You can also always tune in on the chat board. There's something going on there that's separate from whatever we're doing all the time. And you can get on there on thevolleyballnetwork.com and then click on the banner above for the Net Live, and you'll find the chat board right there. So, and get us on iTunes. That's the other place a lot of people I know are getting us, is through iTunes, getting us as a podcast. We know you love to listen on demand when you want to hear us. So send us an email. If you have some response to what we have said on the show, a guest, a topic, a discussion, go ahead and send us an email, thenetlive@gmail.com. But yeah, go ahead and give us a call right now, anytime here during the show, 347-677-1525. All right, guys. I think, let's see, got Reed. You're still hanging in there? No, Reed's gone. Still have Brandon, though. Brandon's there.
As always, baby.
Yeah, you're hanging in. I don't know about Reed. Here's Reed. Yeah, yo, call me back on Skype. So that's two. We're dealing with Russian internet here, so you know this is not on our technology side at all. We've had several poor technology problems, but this is not us. This is purely
that's
Russian.
That's most that Reed's been on in a long time.
Yeah, that was a long time. All right. Well, I believe we have our next guest in the queue. We're going to go for the intro and hope that it's right. I'm just going to go out on a limb here. Our first guest is in his 12th season with the Michigan Wolverines. In 2009, he took the team to its first Elite Eight appearance and ended the year with the most wins in his tenure, 27-10 overall. His team is currently 23-7 overall, 12-6 in the Big Ten, and coming off a 2-win weekend, posting a 3-1 victory over Purdue and a 3-0 over Indiana this past Saturday. Welcome, Michigan Wolverine head coach Mark Rosen. Mark, are you there?
Yeah, I actually thought I wouldn't answer and see if it freaked you guys out or not.
I'm here. It's happened to us several times, believe me. Well, hey, Mark, this is Kevin Barnett sitting in the home court. We have Brandon Rosenthal from Lipscomb University online, and Reed Pretty, at least for now, is joining us. And we appreciate you spending the time.
Looking forward to it. It should be fun.
We wanted to start you off with, we mentioned your record of success last week, and this year your team has looked strong again. Tell us about your current group of kids.
Well, you know, we're fortunate to have a good small senior class, but Lexi Zimmerman, our setter, is really a pretty big difference maker. And since she's come in the program 4 years ago, we've taken some pretty good steps, and I certainly would have to relate a lot of that to her. So we're blessed to have her, and unfortunately her senior night was on Friday night, so it's her time's coming to an end, or Saturday night, which means her time's coming to an end, but that's the unfortunate reality of college athletics. But we've also got a great, strong junior class that's making a big impact. Alex Hunt, who is kind of proving to be one of the better players in the Big Ten right now, and she's, I think, number one or two in point scoring and kills. So she's making a great impact and is having an outstanding junior year. And this year has to carry more of a load. She's been more of a role player the last couple of years, but this year she's the role player. And then we've got three freshmen starting for us right now, which is always can create a circus. So it's a little interesting. But they're doing a great job and getting better every day, so it's been a plus.
Yeah, you mentioned senior setter Lexi Zimmerman. She's been a big part of that. And on this program, we've talked about the coach needing to kind of release leadership and responsibility for a lot of situations to the players on the court. Has she been the person who's taken all of that onto the court for you and really taken away some of the in-game duties that maybe you'd have to have if you had a younger team out there?
Yeah, you know, we say the same things as far as leadership, that early in the year maybe we can be the leaders and we can kind of set the tone and set the pace, but at some point the players have to start driving the bus. And if we're driving the bus at the end of the year, it's going to crash. And so this year has been, I guess, like every other year, we've had to develop that process. And you know, Lexi's a good leader. She's really serving a good role. But, you know, last year there was players ahead of her in that regard, and so she didn't have to. And it was a process of getting her to take over that leadership and really take on the ownership of the team. And the good thing this year is we've got, I think, throughout the team, we've got some of that going on. And Lexi is certainly the one who's mixing the drink. She's the quarterback of it. But I think our libero, Junior Sloan Donoff, is doing a really nice job as a leader as well. And then Alex Hunt has really stepped up this year. So we've got a group of three that I think really do drive things. And we had a struggle a couple of weeks ago. We were on, not this weekend, but the weekend before, we really struggled. And it was good to see those kids really step up in the locker room and in the gym and try and make some changes and affect some changes in the team. And so I think there is good leadership going on, and Lexi's certainly driving it to the most part, I'm sure.
Your team sits third in the Big Ten standings. Do you think it's a foregone conclusion that you guys will be in the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, I do feel comfortable with that. You know, you never want to tempt the NCAA or volleyball gods. But we felt pretty good. We've got some pretty significant wins. We've got 23 wins now and some pretty good ones over good teams. So, you know, the nice thing is last week when we were struggling, we really hit kind of a roadblock in the Minnesota-Iowa road trip last week, and we were struggling. We came back, and we saw a lot of things on tape that we needed to fix and a lot of things we needed to get better at. But we, as coaches, we felt like we can do that without the pressure of only we have to win this many games to get in the tournament on top of it. And so it allowed us to get back in the gym and really just kind of go almost like a preseason mentality where we started breaking some things down to try and get back on track, not worrying about whether we had to win the next two or three games. And I think it really helped maybe make that process a little faster because there wasn't that need to win right now. So, yeah, I think we're in pretty good shape, but, you know, you never know. And the more you do in the regular season, the better your road is in the NCAA tournament. And that's certainly something we are focused on, that we want to have the best draw possible.
Yeah, when talking about the road during the regular season, when you're scheduling outside of your conference, I notice a wide variety of opponents from all over the nation on your schedule this season. What's your philosophy as you set that schedule outside of your required conference competition?
Well, it's a good question. It changes every year. You know, last year we had a very veteran team with a junior, senior-dominated team that really had a lot of success and been to the Sweet 16 the year before, and we wanted to take that next step to hopefully get to the Final Four. And so we had a great, strong preseason, and we played Nebraska, and we played a lot of really good teams to kind of set ourselves up for the season. This year, we knew we were going to have at least two or three freshmen probably in the mix. We had young leadership, a lot of new roles. We scheduled very differently, and I thought our preseason was probably too weak this year. We came out of preseason, I think our RPI was probably around 100. But we also knew that the conference, we have a fortune of being in the Big Ten, where your RPI is going to kind of balance itself out as the year goes on because you're going to play 20 matches against really good teams. So we knew that would happen, and, you know, since then our RPI has moved up into a respectable zone. But it would probably hurt us maybe a little bit in the seeding process, but I don't think we would have had the opportunities to play in the preseason and try some different stuff and try some different lineups and not worry as much about playing top teams, then I think we maybe wouldn't be where we are now. So each year is different. You know, next year we'll be fairly conservative in our scheduling as well because we'll have a freshman setter or a freshman or a new setter at least because we have a junior or a sophomore in our program right now. And so, you know, we'll need to give them a chance to be successful, but in a couple of years we'll probably go with a really aggressive schedule again.
You're listening to Net Live here on the volleyballnetwork.com. We're talking to Michigan Wolverine head coach Mark Rosen. Mark, we've talked on this program a lot about the different types of coaches, and we've kind of put it into two different categories: the teachers who develop players and the strategists who utilize players and their abilities. How'd you characterize your style?
You know, that's a great question. It's good to be on this show because you guys know volleyball. Sometimes you get on these radio shows locally and they don't have a clue. So kind of cool. I speak at coaches' clinics. I talk about the concept of, I think there's artists and there's scientists in coaching. And the scientists are great technicians and the tactics, and they've got all the techniques for teaching the skills. And the artists are the ones that know how to build the team and work with the personalities and all the different personalities within their group. And so, you know, I think we strive to be both good scientists and good artists. Though I think we probably, if I fall short on either side, it might be the science side. I get a little more wrapped up in the art. But I think both are equally important. You know, the last few weeks, we got away from the science a little bit, and we weren't maybe as working on the technique as much as we needed to. And this last week, we got back to working more on the technical side of the game. But I like putting a team together. I like trying to figure out how the pieces fit and how to motivate each player and how to connect with each player and get the most out of them. So I don't know if that makes a lot of sense, but I guess if I was looking at the style of coach I am, I think that I'm an artist striving to be a better scientist.
I think there's always both parts of that to anybody, and any coach who's really self-reflective at all, I think would find themselves wishing they were a little bit more of some part of the program. I think it's always a an important part of anyone's life to continue developing, whether you're playing, coaching, no matter what you're doing in life. So I think,
and as a head coach too, going out and finding people to surround yourself with or maybe good at the other things. And Lisa, you know, my wife is our associate head coach, and we've coached together for 17 years now, and we see the game very similarly, which was fortunate, but we approach it totally different. And I think that's a huge plus, because she's absolutely more of the scientist. I mean, she's more who's way into training and technique and reps. And so I think we balance each other pretty well, which is fortunate.
Well, yeah, and talking about those abilities, tell us about how those abilities then affect your decisions about division of duties inside of your coaching program. You have your wife, you have another assistant coach. So how do you divvy up the day-to-day and the overall arcing things that go into putting a successful volleyball program together?
The first thing I learned when we first started coaching together, we were in our first year of marriage as well, that we better have some pretty strong divisions of labor or we're going to have some issues. And we had some, you know, there was some battle some nights where I'd step on her toes or she'd step on mine. And so we've really learned how to, you know, there's areas of the program that she's responsible for, and I stay the heck out of those things and vice versa. And we communicate a lot about them, but, you know, and I probably step on her toes way more than she steps on mine. And I immediately learned that maybe I shouldn't do that. I do think it creates an interesting dynamic for the other staff members, though, because Lisa and I talk about this all the time. You know, we don't leave it at the office. We're at home, sitting around the house. We'll talk about it and even make some decisions. And so I have to make I try to do this as much as possible, come to the office in the morning and really kind of fill in everybody else on what's going on, because often Lisa just knows because we're talking about it all the time. And I think it's an interesting dynamic, but it's one that I've really enjoyed because, you know, how else could I have kept a great assistant coach for 17 years? You know, she had would have had plenty of opportunities to be head coaches, you know, head coach at a lot of other programs, and has chosen to stay, which is good for our family and for our job. But I think it's also great for our players because there's such continuity in what we're doing here, and I think there is a sense of family within our program too because of having the husband-wife connection.
Okay, that's an interesting question. Has there ever been a situation where there's been a job opportunity for Lisa and there's been some talk about her leaving your program, perhaps going out on her own, or has that never come up?
You know, actually, you were talking about those divisions of labor. We actually had 4 or 5 years ago when we had our second child, and we were having a rough year, and it was hard because we're balancing, you know, now two kids and one was an infant, and she really decided she was going to stop coaching and get out of the business just to be able to help to do a better job. You know, she felt a better job of raising our family. And at the time, she was our recruiting coordinator as well. And I think that was the hardest part because both of us were out on the road recruiting a lot. Both of us were involved. You know, recruits will call any time of day or night, you know, and you got to answer and you got to be there for them. And so we actually hired another assistant to take over the recruiting responsibilities, and then she was going to step down completely. But as we got the recruiting coordinator in, all of a sudden she realized, hey, you know, I like this job a lot, and I like what I do as long as I don't have to be out recruiting or taking calls from recruits 24/7. And so she kind of backpedaled and said, hey, look, wait, I don't, you know, I went to our administration and said, you know, I want to second think this, and if we can just change our roles around, maybe this would be a really good fit. And the administration really didn't want her to go, so they were like, sweet, let's make that happen. And it's worked out to be awesome because I think she's realized now that had she left the business, she would have been miserable as a stay-at-home mom. It just doesn't fit her. And so I think it was one of those things that just kind of happened by accident a little bit and worked out to be awesome. But it was the one time I think she thought about maybe getting out of the business. I do have to say, too, when the Ohio State job opened a couple years ago and Jim Stone, which was her coach, retired, that was intriguing for her because she played at Ohio State. You know, and she was a Hall of Fame player at Ohio State and a Ohio State Athlete of the Year and a Big Ten Player of the Year at that program, and it was intriguing. But she also knew, being in Michigan, that was probably going to be a prohibitive interest. And we've really done a great job and liked what we've built up here, and not only in the program but in our lives and in our family and, you know, with our kids being in school. So it was one of those things that in the back of our mind seemed interesting, but I think in reality wasn't going to be a possibility.
Yeah, your wife, Lisa, listed as one of the 50 greatest athletes ever from Alaska. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And probably some sled dog racers in there with her and some up Tommy Moe, a pretty good skier. But, you know, she was a great athlete and still has a pretty good fire about her. If you're ever in one of our matches, she's pretty fiery.
Okay, so worst weather, Alaska or Michigan?
It depends on what part of Michigan. It's a big state. We coached for 4 years up in the UP, the Upper Peninsula, And the UP rivals Alaska and probably gets more snow than what we had in Anchorage because it's right on Lake Superior. So if I had to choose between the UP or back up in Alaska, I'd probably choose Alaska. But we joke about the fact that both of us, it's a good place to be from, which means we don't want to be there now. It was great as a kid, but I got no interest in ever moving back up there.
Excellent. Rose or Reed, get in here.
I've known Mark just been passing and talking with him, and it's kind of interesting hearing other coaches talk about the style, and I think the artist and the scientist is a great thing. I think the other question a lot of coaches get asked is kind of the numbers, and the and this Kevin from being with McGowan and whatnot. Mark, are you a numbers coach or are you a kind of play by go with your gut, coach?
Well, I think there's a little of both, and I think the numbers are really important. And they don't lie, though you can manipulate a lot of things with numbers. You can look at it from different aspects and see different things based on the numbers. But, we certainly look at a lot of statistical information, rotational analysis, and trying to figure out where we need to be spending our time training, where we maybe need to be aligning our team based on those things and making some decisions based on some empirical numbers rather than just our gut and our feel. But there's also times where I think you can get overloaded by those numbers and feel like, they take you in a certain direction. And we had a great example this year. We've got our number one hitter, Alex Hunt, who's number one or two in kills and points per game in the Big Ten. And we've got her in the L2 spot, which is a little bit unorthodox. And we did it so we could use her more out of the back row, and we just felt that it aligned us better. Well, as our middle blocker, the freshman middle blocker, Jen Cross from Canada, was getting better and really starting to take more over in the offensive load, and they're sitting there next to each other. By the way, we have it aligned right now. Well, we decided, hey, it made more sense statistically to separate them and put Alex back in the one spot so that they were separated and they weren't taking sets away from each other. Hey, that sounded awesome in the office and, looking at the stats. And then we did it, and for four matches, we kept that lineup, and both numbers went down. And so then we started looking at it and realizing that them being next to each other was actually helping each of them out because there was more attention. They couldn't pay attention to one of them as much. And we could still use Alex out of the back row more when she's, in the game with our L2, which is, technically our L1, our weaker left side. So it just worked out better to keep her in the L2 spot. And we made that decision based on thinking we were making good, sound statistical information, and it turned out to be a really bad decision. So, I think you just have to balance both of them. And I think anything in life, if you're too extreme, and I see some coaches that are all about the numbers, and I see some that are like, hey, the numbers are cloud the issue. I go, well, the numbers are the numbers. There's fact. So I think you got to look at both.
Coach, we appreciate you taking the time here. I had one more topic I wanted to get your opinion on before we let you go. And that is, you mentioned the stress of the recruiting game for you as a coaching staff and how it was affecting you and your family. Do you think the recruiting game is out of control for both coaches and junior players?
Speaking for somebody right in the middle of it, absolutely. And it's one of those things that we can't figure out I have a pretty good idea how it got here, but can't figure out how to put the genie back in the bottle and how to move it in a more, I guess, sane direction. And it's everybody thinks that, the recruits. Every time I talk to a recruit and they're on campus, and we had three kids here this weekend that were all sophomores in high school. They're 2013 recruits. So they don't have driver's license yet. They're not allowed to date yet. But they're trying to figure out what college they're going to go to. And you ask them about how their grades are, and you realize you're only hearing about their freshman grades. And so it's crazy. And the players are all saying, hey, it's too fast, it's too fast. And as coaches, most of us are saying it's too fast, it's too fast. But yet we can't slow it down. And a great example is those recruits this weekend. Two of them had already been offered by rival Big Ten schools. And so we were in a position where, hey, we've got to make a decision because these kids have already had scholarship offers placed on them. We're in business. We're in a business where we have to be able to do our job, and so then we have to make those decisions. I think it's just there is something that has to be done, but none of us can figure out what it is. And I know the NCAA is looking closely at it, not just in volleyball, but in all sports. And in volleyball, I think soccer is dealing with the same things, and softball and basketball and football. And there's even legislation on the table to try and limit the date that you can make an offer. And there's a lot of people that say, well, God, how are you going to mandate that? You can't police it. Well, there's a lot of rules in the NCAA you can't police, but just because you can't police it doesn't mean it's not a good rule.
Can the NCAA step in and put a moratorium on offering until senior years or until the end?
The proposal right now is that they wouldn't be able to offer a scholarship, make any kind of verbal offer to a player, their parents, or their coaches, you know, through their coaches, until July 1st after their junior year. And you'd have to have academic transcripts on record from them. So at least it means you've looked at their academic progress and seen if they would be a reasonable candidate for your university. I think it's a great idea. The only argument I ever hear against it is, can you police it? And that's where I think originally I was kind of there going, dumb rule, you can't police it, why have it? But I'm kind of at a point now where we got to try something. You know, it's so out of control, we got to make an effort. And just because, you know, it's hard to enforce speeding, but yeah, we're going to have speed limits. And so just because something's hard to enforce, or seatbelt laws, they're great laws, even though, yeah, it's hard to enforce it because you can't get a seat inside their car. Just because it's hard to enforce doesn't mean it's not a right rule. And so I'm kind of a fan now of them looking at that possibility. And what I think it could do is it would allow the parents and the players and the club coaches to know that rule exists. And if college coaches are out there blatantly breaking that, I think it's going to be a little self-regulating in the sense that the coaches who do that are going to look maybe pretty irreparable. And if I'm a parent, I don't want my kid going to play for somebody who doesn't have any respect for the rules. So maybe it self-regulates a little bit where people, you know, get away with it a little bit, but then sooner or later it ends up hurting their reputation. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes, but I agree with you that it is kind of an out-of-control topic and issue that none of us seem to be able to get our hands around.
Head coach Mark Rosen has led his team to another successful season and expecting to enter the NCAA tournament. Coach, we wish you the best of luck coming up here in the NCAA tournament. We'll follow your progress, and thanks so much for spending the time with us here on the Net Live.
Thanks, I enjoyed it.
All right, Mark Rosen. Michigan Wolverines, good record this year, 23-7. That's pretty nice. That's pretty nice. Rosendahl, you still hanging in there? I think we still have Reed on the line.
I'm here, baby. I'm here.
I want to know.
You
Kevin,
know who else
you,
is here? Alex Kelly is dying to get on the phone.
Could I coach with my wife? Was that the question?
That's the question.
Yeah. No way. No. She can do the accounting. But she doesn't know enough about volleyball.
My wife's an attorney, so she would win every argument anyways.
Yeah, just be her team. All right, you know what, Alex, how much time does Alex Kelly have? Because we have another guest scheduled right now.
She's here, so let's move on. We'll get to her.
I mean, she doesn't have to go to class or anything, does she?
Actually, she's out of school. We're out of school all week this week. It's a beautiful thing.
You got the whole week off, too? When did this start? See, when I was in college, you didn't get off till like Wednesday, and I'm slogging home in traffic on a Wednesday to try and get back for
I agree, man.
Day. Should have given me the whole
first
week.
First time I heard about it, I was like, what do you mean we get off the whole week? And, so it's quiet in the office here.
Hey, you got a couple callers in the queue. I'm going to try and blow through these real quick. 310, you're on the air with the Net Live. Who are you? Where are you calling from?
Is this me?
Hello. Yes.
Kevin Barnett. It's Michael Seeley calling.
Michael Seeley. I forgot.
How are you, my friend?
I'm glad you're calling. Head coach.
Did you forget that I was calling?
I have it here. It's just not written in the point that I'm at in my outline.
No problem. Whatever fits.
No. Hey, Mike, thanks for calling in. UCLA, it's been a great season so far. We know you have a couple of reasons to call in. One is legitimate. One is very sketchy. Just give us the legitimate one.
I only was aware of one reason I was calling. I'm not sure about the sketchy one.
Okay.
I was definitely calling about Movember because I've been rocking a mustache all month, and I think it just needs to be addressed. So,
Mike, are you participating in No Shave November?
I've had this mustache strapped to me since November 1, and it's getting to that point where it's kind of curling over my upper lip and affects my eating. So I'm always thinking about it. And I came back from, we were up at the Oregon this weekend and going through all the airports. There are tons of young gentlemen who are definitely rocking mustaches that don't normally. So I had a lot of Movember conversations in airports.
Is there any pictures online? I got to check this out.
So here, that you know what? I will do that today, I promise.
Have we really gone from Mark Rosen in a discussion about the NCAA tournament to your food not entering your mouth because it's stuck on your mustache, Mike?
Barney, it's all about balance. It's life balance. And if we want to change, and I listen to the whole conversation, we want to we want to change the recruiting and all, just the natural, you know, culture of this. So we need to break it down, talk about mustaches, and relax a little bit.
I think coaches having mustaches with all kinds of food stuck in them might definitely have an effect on recruiting.
I'm definitely going to challenge Mick. I'm challenging Mick Haley officially right now for a mustache contest for next year. He's got a year to
think about it. Forget the Pac-10 championship.
It's challenge all Pac-10 coaches to a stash off.
Stash off
next year.
The Pac-10 stash off. Pac-10
stash off for sure.
Mike, give us a quick update on where your team is. Mike, it's been a good season so far. First year for you and your staff. Give us the 2 minute. Summary.
Two minute summary on my year.
Yes.
Well, we went in with no expectations, just thinking about how good are we going to be in December, and we're okay. You know, watching video is when the season started. We watched a lot of video and roll our eyes and a bunch of things to get addressed. In the last few video sessions, there's not that much glaring stuff. I think we're a decent team right now.
I like it. Who do you have coming up? What remains on your Pac-10 schedule?
We got SC on Friday, day after Thanksgiving at 5 p.m., and after that, just waiting for the selection show on Sunday morning.
What are your expectations for that?
For SC, I mean, they're by far the most physical team in the country. It just depends on the matchup. You know, they've had a couple, you know, Cal wins the Pac-10. They're only two losses in the year against SC, so they're doing some great things. But SC's also had a couple defeats, or they've gone five with a couple teams that they were much more physical than, so I just need to watch that tape and figure out how people are trying to exploit them.
And for the selection show, are you expecting to be in the tournament this year?
I would assume so. I mean, we're 21-6 or something like that. We've got, you know, beat Stanford when they were one, beat Washington when they were seven. So we've beaten enough good teams, I would assume we're in.
Okay, very good. Hey, Mike, we appreciate you calling in. We got to move on.
Move on, Movember.com.
I like it.
You got it. See you, bud.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. All right, here we are in the Net Live. We appreciate you listening in. I now want to bring into the Net Live our next guest. Well, we're just packed with guests lately. I can't believe it. We got all kinds of people calling into this show. I like that. Like, we're delivering this product every week to you. And being that it's tournament time, we want to talk to another college coach. This is a man who spent 34 seasons as a high school coach, winning 21 state championships and amassing an incredible record of 1,183 wins. I mean, that's an unimaginable number, and only 95 losses, which put him in the AVCA Coaches Hall of Fame in 2007. His team was the number one seed this past weekend in the MAC tournament and completed a regular season record of 24-4 with a 14-2 conference mark after being 7-9 just 1 year ago before this man took over the job. Steve Shondell of Ball State, thanks for joining us here on the Net Live.
You're welcome, Kevin. It's certainly an honor, and I've listened or watched you many times on television, so I'm thrilled to be able to talk to you for the first time.
Well, awesome. We appreciate you taking the time to come on and be a part of our program. Hey, I know this past weekend was a disappointment, but let's first talk about the incredible season you had leading up to that, 24-4 overall, while starting four freshmen. Talk about your philosophy in blending veteran and rookie players this season.
Well, I was very fortunate that the former coach brought in a really good freshman class for this year, and Dave Booz left for Florida last spring, and the recruiting was completed, and he left me a group of experienced players plus a outstanding group of young freshmen, and they've come together with a good chemistry, and it was just one of those years where things fell into place, and somehow we managed to go 24-4, and it's been a great year.
Well, you've won 7 of 8 5-set matches this year, and that with a young team seems remarkable to me. What is it about your team that allows them to prevail so often in that 5-set, just kind of stressed environment?
You know, I think the key to all that has been in most of those matches that we've won in 5 games, we've been able to get off to a good start early, and we do handle the ball pretty well. We're fairly fundamentally sound, don't make a lot of errors, and we've just been consistent enough to hold on and win a lot of those close 5-game matches. But you mentioned earlier, the thing that's been kind of surprised, we've been able to do that with a lot of young players.
Yeah, unfortunately, this past weekend, perhaps the young players bitch in the butt. I don't know. Tell us what happened. You lost the number 8 seed Toledo Rockets in straight sets in the quarterfinal of your tournament.
Right. You know, Toledo is a team that has done very, very well at home this year. And it so happened that we play our MAC tournament in Toledo. And I think we were actually the last team to beat them at home about a month and a half ago. And they've had a lot of really good wins at home. They're a good, solid, fundamentally sound team. And we went into the tournament. We had won 10 in a row in our league and wrapped up the conference championship about a week and a half ago. And been feeling really good about ourselves. And we had actually just beaten Toledo three straight a week ago in our conference championship match here in Muncie. And that may not have helped us either. They just came out after us. We're very focused. They had the home crowd and home crowd behind them. They just played a great, great match. And we had a chance to win game one. We were up 24-22 and ended up losing the thing 28-26. And that kind of took a little bit of wind out of our sails and gave them a lot of confidence. And before you know it, we were beaten three straight.
Well, it sets up an interesting situation for your team, given the year that you've had, and you were number one seed in your conference tournament, but yet went out in the quarters. How are you approaching this week, given that you may or may not get into the NCAA tournament?
Well, that's a great question. You know, we practice today, and we're going to practice tomorrow before the girls go home for a Thanksgiving break. We're approaching it like we're going to be in the tournament, but yet we know that, traditionally the MAC has only got one team in. We did get three teams in a couple years ago, but that's been a very rare occasion. And I look at this year, we went 14-2 in the MAC and won the league by two games. The next best team was Western Michigan with four losses. And, you know, the league goes over a two-month span, and it's unfortunate that what you do over 2 months comes down to what you do in a three-match weekend in a conference tournament. And I'm just hoping that the committee will look at that and realize we have won our last 10. Our conference has been as good as it's ever been. I think everyone in our division has been in the top 100 in the RPI throughout the course of the year, and we've been in the low 40s. So we're just staying optimistic and hoping that this year will be a year that the MAC will get two or three teams in again.
Yeah, I've looked down the Pac-10 standings in particular. We've been looking at some of the bigger conferences and schools and looking at a Washington who's 8-8 in their own mm-hmm. conference, Oregon who's 6-10. I mean, these teams are 19-8 overall, 18-10 overall, decent records when you look at the overall, but in their conference they're not doing well. Do you think they're more mm-hmm. deserving than a team like yours, which you dominated the matches you're required to play in your conference?
Right. That's a great question. I really don't even know how to answer that question, to tell you the truth. I can just, based on what we've done this year and the great season we've had in a very good league and to go 14-2 and win the league by two games, I just feel like, that's certainly worthy of very serious consideration for the tournament.
How have your players been? This is your first year. You said that the cupboard was not left bare, but these were not players that you recruited. How has that transition process been with you coming in and taking over your program?
It's been a great transition. We have not had any chemistry problems this year within our team. I don't think I've had a girl come in with a single complaint all season. It's just been a year where the team has come together as one and been willing to bind everything that our coaching staff has brought to the table. And it's been a year where this group has been able to gain a lot of confidence and have a lot of fun. And they've really, come together and enjoyed the season. And it's really almost hard to describe. Everything has gone so well.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that you've had the success you've had. And so many other coaches you see come in, there's a lot of people getting upset, and then they have a bad year, and then half the team leaves or more. I think about a Colorado where nearly the entire team turns over inside of 1 year. I mean, you having seen both sides of the recruiting issue and bringing kids out of high school and bringing them into college, do you think that the decision is more based on the volleyball program for your athletes at Ball State, or is it more based on their love of the university and their goals within as a student athlete for the Ball State University?
I really think a little bit of both. I think we've got a great volleyball tradition here, and I think a lot of the student athletes come here because of our tradition, but yet they also, these kids that are here, have a great love for the university. We've got a beautiful campus here at Ball State, and they love getting their education here, so I really think it's a combination of both.
You're listening to Net Live here on the VolleyballNetwork.com. We're talking to Ball State head coach of women's program, Steve Shondell, in his first season. Steve, you spent 34 seasons as a high school coach, 21 state championships, produced a lot of great players. Tell us about your opinion of seeing the recruiting process, and you also run a volleyball club. So Tell us about the recruiting process and how you view it from that side of the fence as a juniors coach and as a high school coach.
Well, as a high school coach, I was always appreciative when college coaches would call me, because I think that so often the college coaches seem to work mostly through the club coaches. And oftentimes I would have players recruited from my high school that never even contacted me. And I think it's really important as a college coach that you communicate both with the club coach and the high school coach to learn as much about the athlete as you possibly can. But so that's kind of my feelings there.
Do you think that the recruiting process is out of control for the athletes? Do you think it's putting too much stress on them?
You know, I heard your interview with Mark Rosen, and you know, it just seems like athletes are being recruited earlier and earlier at such a young age. And I know for many, many years as a high school coach, my players were never recruited until either their junior or senior year. And now if you're not watching 8th graders, 9th graders, and 10th graders, you're behind the ball. So, I think it is somewhat getting out of control, because it's obviously tough for those young kids at a freshman and sophomore in high school to have to make those decisions. But in today's game, today's world, that's what they're having to do.
Coach, your father, Don Shondell, was an incredible coach at Ball State for a very long time. You worked for him for a time, and in addition to doing your own things, what are some of the great things that you took from him and his styles, and what are some of the things that you didn't want to repeat that he would do with his players?
Well, I was so fortunate that I actually grew up with a father that coached here at Ball State, and gave me the opportunity at the age of 5 to start attending Ball State volleyball practices. And I still think to this day there's probably not a home match that I have not attended in the last 50 years. So I was very, very blessed to have a father in this sport, because it gave me an opportunity to be a volleyball player and to be a volleyball coach. But I took a lot of things from him. I think the thing that my dad did, he developed great passion in the players that he coached and great loyalty to the university. And my dad's been such an ambassador for this sport. He's still, at 82 years old, he's still working with our 10 and under volleyball program here at Muncie-Anne, and still coaching the 8th grade girls at Burris, the school that I coached at for all those years. So he is still totally involved in the sport and gave me the opportunity to become a volleyball coach, and I certainly will be grateful to him forever.
Yeah, an incredible record you had with the high school. Is there a ton of stress placed on your predecessor? what's the word I'm looking for? Not predecessor, the next person in line.
Right, right. You know, when I... It was a really, really tough decision for me to leave Burris and come to Ball State. Number one, we had a lot of great players coming up. And this year, in Tang Harnish's first year as the head coach at Burris, they went 39-0 and are currently ranked second in the nation in 2 or 3 national polls and won the state championship this year here in Indiana. So I'm just absolutely thrilled with the job that she did. I mean, she did something that I would never do, and that would be take that position. I think there were 2 people that actually applied for the job when it was all said and done, and she had the courage to do it, and I'm just so thrilled that the team went undefeated this year and won the state championship.
So maybe she's even better. Who knows?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think she is.
Well, hey, I'll get you out of here on this, Steve. We appreciate your time here. I want to know,
wonderful,
who was the best men's volleyball player you ever saw through Ball State? You say you have a mismatch in 50 years, who's the best men's volleyball player?
Great question. You know, we've had one player that went on to become a member of the Olympic team. That was Phil Etherton. You probably are very familiar with that name.
He was my roommate, as a matter of fact, in 2004.
Oh, what a great guy. When he came to Ball State, I had to talk my dad into letting him come here, because he had no volleyball skill at all when he graduated from high school in St. Louis. And I looked at some video on him and said, this guy's got potential. And he wanted a little bit of money. I think Dad offered him like a $500 scholarship. And that was enough to get him to come and accept that small scholarship to Ball State. And when he first got here, all the players, I was actually coaching with my dad at that time, all the players made fun of him because he just had no skill. And you know his personality. He's one of the most unique personalities of anybody that you'll ever know. He collected all those little McDonald's toys and so forth. And a lot of the players made fun of him, but I always told our guys, someday the joke's going to be on you because this guy is going to be a good player. And we worked and worked with Phil, and he got better every single year. And then, of course, has went on to become the only Ball State player in history to make the Olympic team. So I have to give him credit for being the best player in Ball State history.
Somewhere Greg Romano is very upset to hear
you
say.
I'm sure he and Todd Reimer and a few Eddie Fraz and a few others, but those are all great players. And Greg was such a competitor. He was a middle blocker here, and then he ended up being a left side, I believe, his senior year. But I tell you what, he's one of the most competitive guys I've ever met. We were just thrilled to see him go on to the national team and do well during his years with the U.S. national team.
I can imagine Phil's reaction when you offered him $500.
Whoa, oh, he was like kid in the candy shop.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Well, terrific stuff, Steve. We hope that your team makes it into the tournament, and if not, we hope you continue your success next season there at Ball State. Thank you so much for spending the time with us here on the program.
Well, I appreciate it, Kevin, and it's been a great honor speaking with you.
Terrific. Thank you. Steve Shondell, head coach of the women at Ball State University, joining us here on the Net Live. Gentlemen, I give you an opportunity for comments about a couple of coaches who I enjoyed talking with just now.
I like Baxter's comment on the chat board. Phil was the worst player to ever set foot in the gym of the Division I school, but turned out to be pretty good.
Phil,
pipe down, Baxter.
He hung around the national team forever, from 1997, I think, up until about 2001. I believe Doug actually cut him in 2001, and they brought him back, and it was either late 03 or early 04 because we were so thin in the middle, and Phil just had a really nice year, played very well, and ended up going to the Olympic Games in 2004, and was really a great player during that year. And my roommate, I had a great time with him at the Olympic Games.
I got a question. Is Seeley growing the mustache, or did he grow the mustache because of they were on a winning streak or whatnot? Because if he did, it's awesome.
You're back to this. It's No Shave November, isn't it? I don't know anything about it because I've got three chest hairs and about five facial hairs. So
you've been growing your mustache for like the past 10 years, like ever since we graduated college.
I'm perpetually 14, but you know, so I've no business in the conversation. But you know, react to some of these guys. I mean, Rose, I want to know from your side too the recruiting game. You're one of these guys who's heavy into recruiting. You know, you do it a lot. That's how you've built your program. It's going out there, pounding the pavement. But you guys are looking at younger and younger kids. And how is it you can look at a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old girl and really come up with what they're going to be like in 3 or 4 years?
I think one thing's for sure. You've got to be very secure in your recruiting style or ability. You know, I think one big mistake out there by a lot of coaches, and regardless of what level they're at, is they're always kind of looking over the shoulder to see what else somebody else is doing. And, you know, we never have recruited that early. But I can see why, you know, programs do. I think it's very fair to say, though, there are plenty of players out there. And, you know, it's interesting. I realize at the higher level, that pool gets a little bit smaller, but I really do think that there's plenty of players out there. I think the NCAA really needs to take a look at this because, it, you know, like Mark was saying, you know, it's getting harder and harder. I mean, you literally are talking to girls that, you know, are just sophomores in high school. And, you know, just even the conversation is hard. You know, at least when you get into juniors and seniors, you know, you talk about, you know, them driving and things like that. I mean, these girls, they're still a year and a half away from,
you know,
their driver's license.
They're girls. They're not even young women at that point. I mean, you're 13.
What do they do on their recruiting trips, by the way?
Juice and crackers, you know. And later, we're going to take you for grams and milk at the cafeteria.
Hey, and by the way, Movember, formerly known as November, is a mustache-growing charity event held during November each year that raises funds and awareness for men's health. So I'm guessing that's what Seeley is doing.
Yes, that is exactly what he's doing. And I just wish that it wasn't sandwiched between two other interviews.
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
Reed, can you grow a mustache?
I can.
Good for you guys, really.
That's awesome.
In fact, I didn't
shave.
No, I mean, out of choice for about a year. I would just do those clipper things until I had a baby. And then facial hair wasn't too, it's not a very good thing for little babies.
Brillo pad stuck on their face.
I just think it's awesome that, you know, while you've been to the Olympics and I haven't, I can grow a mustache and you can't. So, you know, I bet you know who can grow a mustache. I know Dan can grow a mustache because we've seen that. But what do you think about Geeter? Can he grow one?
Yeah. Good question.
Yeah, we'll have to have him on. We'll have a whole discussion about mustaches. And I'll hang up and you guys can just talk about it. That'll be good. All right, we've got to move on here to College Volleyball Weekly. And you know what that means. Still,
what song do we got this week?
No, still number one. We're going back to the old standards since no one can knock them off. Each week, the Net Live and the American Volleyball Coaches Association is proud to present the College Volleyball Weekly, a recap of what has happened in the world of college volleyball. Wait for it. Since they're still on top, we get a go Gators. Florida still riding high. I like it. It's going to be hard to beat that music for whoever ends up number one. All right, let's bring into the conversation a gentleman we now know well, Dave Reed from ESPN.com. Dave, welcome back to another week.
What a great week it was.
I'll tell you what, there were some good matchups out there, huh?
There really were. And, you know, since we're going with the Go Gator theme, we'll just mention that it looks like Florida's going to go through the SEC undefeated after the big win at LSU. You know, that's a remarkable thing that Mary's done. They dropped the SEC title last year to the Tigers, but got it back this year.
Yeah, they defeated Arkansas this week 3-1 and also took down number 16 LSU, as you mentioned, 3-1. A couple of good wins.
Yeah, and, you know, Mary's got a great team. You know, I'm already starting to look and see where the NCAA might place the Gators for the tournament. You know, they're going to be number one seed, but it's going to be interesting where they put them. Will they be the top seed at Texas or maybe the top seed at the Dayton Regional? It remains to be seen.
All right. It looks like also number 7 Penn State continues their hot play, 3-0 to Ohio State and 3-0 number 25 Northwestern. They seem like a team that's finally figured it out.
I think you're right, and I think one of the things that got him going was when Russ decided to not redshirt Ariel Scott, get her in the lineup, and she kind of filled the place that Darcy Dorton would have had in the lineup this year, and that seemed to kind of get him going, and then he's used some different players, depending on matchups, what he likes to see each week. You know, he had Katie Slate, going in, played really well for a few matches. Fatima Balsa is playing really well in the middle right now, so it looks like he's got some things that he can do depending on who they're playing and what challenges his opponents present for his team.
All right, looking further down the list here, number 8, Texas had a good week, getting a couple of wins, and then number 9, Illinois, defeated Iowa 3-1, but then stumbled against number 19, Minnesota, going down in 5.
Yeah, that one kind of surprised me with Illinois losing at home to Minnesota. But, you know, the Gophers are healthy now and could present a problem for the final match of the year for Penn State. So, you know, it's going to be interesting in the Big Ten to see if Penn State can run the table and pull off that 8th consecutive Big Ten title. And I think if they do, I think they're going to end up being the number one seed in their own regional.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what happens with that. And also with the selection show. I mean, here we have selection time coming up. We just talked to Michigan. They're expecting to get in out of the Big Ten. We talked to Ball State and Steve Shondell. He's in a rather weird position now, having won his conference in the regular season, had a great year, and then went down in the quarterfinal. Like you said, he had one bad match, and you can even just have one off weekend, and all of a sudden all the work you did over the year doesn't mean anything. Do teams like Ball State deserve to get in the tournament instead of maybe a 5th or 6th team out of one of the big conferences?
Well, you know what? It's all going to depend on what happens with the rest of the conference tournaments. The good news for a team like Ball State so far, there hasn't been anything really crazy going on in the tournaments that, you know, traditionally only get one team in. You know, Ohio University out of the MAC, they ended up winning it. They didn't lose a set, and I think they were going to get in anyway. You know, the biggest losses so far in the tournaments, Cincinnati lost to Louisville, and Louisville was kind of a bubble team, you know, at 44th in the latest RPI. Cincinnati's still going to get in. That's not a problem. You know, Northern Iowa, they're sixth in the RPI. It doesn't matter what happens in the Missouri Valley Conference tournament this week. You know, they're playing for maybe a top 16 seed, as is Hawaii. You know, Hawaii didn't get much love from the selection committee last year, and I wouldn't suspect, even though, you know, they were going to be a top four team, that they might end up getting shipped out to be a number two seed somewhere.
Yeah, it's interesting that you can just sort of do it that way. Take a team maybe you don't like, you don't respect, and no matter what they've done. I mean, Hawaii, 27-1, 16-0 in the WAC. You have to think that's a number one seed.
Yeah, but you know what? I think it's more of a statement about the committee's not impressed with the overall depth of the WAC. You know, we haven't really seen Hawaii play anybody that strong, you know, for the last month and a half. So, you know, when you start looking at teams like, you know, Stanford, who may not win the Pac-10, you know, if Cal ends up winning, they've got to be number one seed. I don't care what year it is. The winner of the Pac-10 is a number one seed, no matter what their record is. You know, Florida's going to be a top seed. I think Nebraska is going to be a number one seed. And then there's a whole bunch of teams, you know, Hawaii, Texas, Stanford, USC. You know, any one of those, you know, are strong enough to be a number one seed, but they won't because of where they finished in their conference.
Yeah, 26 teams already qualified for the tournament out of the 30 automatic spots that are available. Got teams like Dayton, Duke, Albany, Lipscomb, some team out of the Atlantic Sun that I've never heard of, Nebraska, Louisville, we mentioned, Louisville, if you prefer, High Point out of the Big South, Cal State, Fullerton, Delaware, Tulsa, Butler, Niagara, Ohio, South Carolina State, Colorado State, Sacred Heart, Austin, American University, Florida out of the SEC, Georgia Southern, UTSA out of the Southland, North Dakota State with their new coach did manage to win this summit. And the Sun Belt goes to Middle Tennessee State, Alabama A&M took the SWAC, and then the West Coast, WCC went to the University of San Diego. So there's still the WAC to be decided, the Big Sky, the Big Ten, Missouri Valley, and the Pac-10 all left for their automatic qualifiers. Then you'll have 34, correct, at-large positions available, Dave?
Yeah. No, actually 33. There's 31 automatic qualifiers. 21 go with the tournament and 10 go with the regular season champ.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, the good news for the bubble teams, like I was saying, there wasn't anything too crazy going on, you know, in the tournaments. You know, there were some good tournaments in the Big East. Second seed of Louisville knocks off Cincinnati. That was a good one. In the Atlantic 10, Dayton had to beat Xavier on Xavier's home court, and they won the regular season and the tournament title without losing a match. So, you know, the top teams have gotten it done.
Who are your bubble teams? Who are you looking at?
Wow. You know, I think you're right about Ball State being on the bubble. Auburn out of the SEC, you know, they're in the top 50 of the RPI, but it's going to be interesting to see how far the selection committee goes down. I think any team out of the Missouri Valley Conference, you know, Northern Iowa's in, but I think Wichita State should get in and possibly even Missouri State. But after that, I don't think you can go four in the Missouri Valley Conference. You know, teams like Pepperdine, New Mexico played well, but New Mexico had a tough loss this week at BYU. So, you know, I would think Michigan's in. You know, we just got off the phone with Mark. So, you know, I think he's in pretty good shape. They had a really good year. And, you know,
yeah, they had a couple of quality wins, including a defeat of Illinois. That was pretty nice.
Yeah, you know, the question is going to be how far the committee wants to go down into each conference. You know, we've talked about that. Do you want to go five or six deep in the Big Ten, Pac-10, Big 12, or do you start rewarding some of the schools that have had really great years?
Right. All right, what's on your radar for this upcoming week, Dave, besides the selection show?
Well, you know, obviously we want to see if Cal can win that first Pac-10 title. You know, the Arizona schools play well. Fortunately, the Bears have them at home, so we'll see if they can pull that off. You know, looking at the Big Ten, it'll be interesting to see if Penn State can finish off this incredible run that they've had. You know, they've won 12 in a row right now, 36 out of 39 sets. Iowa, not the strongest team, but that last match at Minnesota, Mike Ebert's teams play well, and they're healthy. So it should be a lot of fun to see what happens.
All right, very good. Dave Reed, ESPN.com, thanks so much for joining us.
All right, have a great week.
All right. We're going to move on now. Correspondent number two sitting in the queue. It's our Pac-10 correspondent. We haven't mentioned it. We kind of glossed over it, but it was a great showdown that happened with number two Stanford going down to Cal 3-1. Holly McPeak, what are your thoughts on that match?
Wow, is all I could say. I was a little bit surprised. You know, Stanford has not lost since running their 6-2, running Krista Cook and Cassidy Lickman. They looked a little sluggish in warmups, and I'll tell you, Cal should have swept them three straight. Cal dominated the first set and let Stanford back in. I think it was 28-26 in the first set, and then Cal Stanford got them, and then the next three were dominated by Cal. Cal looked really good, never hit below 340 as a team.
It's one of those cases where a team like that just gets hot during a certain match, and you mentioned Stanford a little bit listless. I mean, you and Dave were both pretty excited about that 6-2 return for Stanford.
Yeah, you know, I think Cal's legit. They pass the ball extremely well. Carly Lloyd, if she doesn't get a good pass, is such a great athlete. She can keep them in system. Tara Murray playing the best ball of her career by far. I mean, I think her career numbers were under 200. Now she's hitting about 350. As an outside hitter, that's tough to do.
Yeah.
So I think the whole system, they're blocking well. They had a great game plan against Stanford. They played phenomenal defense. They're the eighth best team in the Pac-10 defensively, but they out-dug, out-blocked, out-hit, out-served Stanford.
By virtue of that victory, Cal puts themselves totally in control of their own destiny. They have two home matches remaining. Dave mentioned Arizona State on Wednesday, Arizona on Friday. Arizona at number 22, they're a good team. They're coming off a defeat of Washington 3-1, so it should be an interesting conclusion to Pac-10.
I think so, too, but I think Cal's really hungry, really hungry. They want it. I think they're going to close it out and win their first Pac-10 title.
What else is on your mind in the Pac-10, and who are you looking at for bubble teams?
Well, in terms of the Pac-10, that obviously closing it out and seeing what the Stanford and Cal teams can do against Arizona State and Arizona, I think that's going to be interesting. UCLA-SC. Now, UCLA might have lost their middle blocker, Katie Camp, and she's their best blocker, their best, you know, middle attacker as well, to a knee injury. They haven't figured out exactly what it is, but that could be a big blow to UCLA.
We could have asked him about it, but when he came on, all he did was talk about his mustache. We didn't really get any relevant information to his team out of him just now. So.
Yeah, he's good about that. So that I think that's a big question mark because UCLA has been giving people fits all season long, pushing the best teams in the country to the brink. I mean, we saw them lose to Cal in five at Cal, 16-14. So that I think UCLA-USC could be a good match, especially if she's back healthy. And then, I you know, there's enough good teams in the Pac-10 to get seven in again. And I know that upsets people sometimes, but the competition is so tight every week, every match, that I think they deserve it.
Okay, I have a question about that because you're talking seven. You're going all the way down to Oregon, who's 6-10. I mean, their win percentage is below 400 in their own conference. I have a hard time believing that that's a good selection. I mean, even Washington at 8-8. I just wonder why that's a better selection than a team that perhaps didn't play well in the last match or in their conference tournament in another, like a Ball State who had a great year. Shouldn't that be rewarded versus a team who's, yeah, they play in a tough conference, but they should be able to recruit against that tough conference and sell that tough conference and sell their big school against a place like Ball State?
Well, they're 18-10 overall. So, I mean, they have a decent winning percentage. Oregon, to be honest with you, this isn't their strongest team. They're very young. They have one senior, and there's a chance they won't be selected. But with a record of 18-10 overall, That's not bad when 10 of them are losses to I think every team is ranked in the top 25. And I don't think a lot of teams can say that.
Well, true. Then you get to an Arizona State. Why shouldn't they be in then? They have an identical conference record to Oregon at 6-10. Then they're 12-17 overall. But, I mean, if you're going to talk just on the strength of the Pac-10 that ought to get them in, shouldn't they also be in since they're 6-10?
No. Well, I think the first rule is you have to have a record over 500. And you can't have an overall record of 12-17 and get in the tournament. So Arizona State needs to have a better preseason. They really struggled with injuries in the preseason, and yeah, that's going to affect their outcome and possibility of getting in the NCAA tournament.
Okay, besides Cal, who else do you think is on a good trajectory here at the end of the season and is peaking at just the right moment?
Well, you mean in the Pac-10?
Sure, in the Pac-10, or give me somebody outside the Pac-10, too. Who are you looking to?
Okay, well, I'm very impressed with what Penn State's been doing lately. I think that they're rolling. They found their lineup. They're in a good place going into the tournament, and so is Texas. And I think that's definitely a good thing. We have the WAC tournament this Wednesday in Las Vegas. You know, Hawaii's been dominating all season long, so they're not going to get tested in probably until regionals. In terms of the Pac-10, SC is playing very well, putting up some big numbers at the net blocking, which has been their weakness. So they could be in a good spot. I mean, they depend a lot on young players, so we'll see how that fares for them in the NCAA tournament.
Interesting, Texas. They've been so wildly up and down this season. I don't think everyone expected the kind of fall off they had towards the middle of the season after their championship appearance last year. But they seem to be a team that's playing well again, defeating Missouri 3-0 and Kansas 3-1. Maybe some of that's just a confidence thing where you get on a roll and you start winning matches and you start feeling better and better about your team, and then it doesn't matter who's on the other side of the net.
Well, they had new players in the lineup. Obviously, they lost their freshman setter, Hannah Allison. Michelle Coker's back in the lineup, and they haven't lost a match since. They don't have a lot of depth. That's their one problem. One player gets hurt, they're in trouble. But the group that's on the floor right now is playing extremely well. Amber Roberson and Julianne Fossett playing much better than they were earlier in the season. And Jennifer Doris and Rachel Adams in the middle, awesome. Two big girls blocking the ball well and putting up some great offensive numbers.
Very good. Looking forward to the week. I know you mentioned the WAC tournament going on in Vegas. Where are you going broadcasting-wise, and what's on your radar?
Well, the good news is I'm off for Thanksgiving. I don't have to go do anything. I'm just doing the selection show on Sunday, which I can't wait for. I think it's going to be really exciting. I mean, it's a wide open field. For the first time in a long time, probably 8 to 10 teams can win it, and it just depends who's hot.
When is the selection show on? Give us a time and place to watch
it. It's on 12 noon Sunday on ESPN News Pacific time, so 3 p.m. Eastern time. And I think it's going to be exciting. I think it's going to be interesting to see where they put everybody, because Washington hosting a region, Dayton hosting a regional as well, and see if those teams can emerge out of those regions and who's going to go where.
Should Lipscomb University get a good seed based on their results?
Can't
say who.
Good question.
I thought they had a great year last year. Well, we've talked a lot about some of these smaller teams, and last year we've got Brandon Rosenthal here on the line, but we had Lipscomb, who went undefeated in their conference, dominated their conference play, and then got seeded in with Cal, which is not a great first-round matchup. And I just wonder if some of those smaller teams can get better matchups or how they go about getting better matchups.
That's a good question. You know, they're not Lipscomb, although they dominated their conference, they have not their RPI is not one of the higher ones. As far as
it's horrendous.
What?
It's not good as good this year as it was last year, no.
Yeah, and that's what makes it tough. I think, you know, after the top 16 get seeded, after that it's you know, it's all about keeping the budgets low and not traveling too far. So hard to say. I don't know what they do after that.
Holly brings up a great point about you know, the difference between the volleyball tournament and the basketball tournament. basketball tournament seeds all 64 teams, while the volleyball tournament only seeds the top 16. So I think apples to apples, you know, could compare the two tournaments, but it is quite different, you know, with that with the seeding process.
Well, Holly makes another good point, too, bringing in the finances of the whole thing. I mean, you seed the first 16, and then doesn't it just become about spending as little money as possible?
That's really the bottom line. When NCAA is trying to save money, and if they can bust somebody as opposed to send somebody on the plane, they're going to do it. And, you know, so that you're going to be put in the closest conference or closest regional there is.
Well, remember that, you know, press release about an $800 million television contract for the basketball. I'll remember that they were trying to save $1,000 on a team's travel volleyball team.
Exactly.
All right, Holly.
Kevin, that's a great point that she talks about with the finances, but I think it's really hard for schools that bust their tails all season long to get to this point and then have to be told, hey, what you did during the season is now going to be determined by the mileage to the closest school. I mean, that's I think if you're going to do it right.
Yeah, I like that this is a 64-team tournament, and I think if you're going to commit to that, then it should be absolutely done on merit. And the NCAA has got the money. And it's a discussion for another day, but the NCAA has got the money to do justice to the tournament in what is the premier sport for women in the NCAA. So you don't see them skimping any money on basketball because maybe it's not quite as big as football. You know, I think you gotta spread the money out and make sure that this tournament is treated with the respect that it deserves. Holly, thanks so much for being on again. We'll look forward to talking to you next week after the selection show.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
Yeah, we can talk about all the great matchups coming up and really start to look at filling out our brackets and have a little net live pool, perhaps.
We should. Let's do it.
Cool. Perfect. Thank you, Holly.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
So, we play it again. Till somebody stops them, this is what you're going to hear.
Can we get like an expedited version, though? Can we cut it down a little bit?
No, it is a perfect length, man. Because now we have time to credit the American Volleyball Coaches Association and the Net Live each week coming together to produce the College Volleyball Weekly. They are. There's sharks in the water. Watch out. No stop in Florida. Big finish. Love it. Love it. I think it's finally here. Tournament time is here. We're finally going to find out where everyone's going and if Brandon Rosenthal and his Lipscomb University Bisons will have to play against number one Cal, perhaps number two Cal, number one Florida.
Cal was good last year, so if they're talking about how good they are this year, I'd be a little nervous about that.
Yeah, you guys need a better matchup. I think last year you got a bum deal. And I seriously am concerned about a team like Washington. I don't really value their record that much, and they've lost three of four. I mean, we've talked about teams that are hot. I don't think Washington is playing very good volleyball down the stretch here. And I don't know that you need to go that deep into the Pac-10. Let's reward some of these other schools.
You know, it's interesting you talk about coming down the stretch. I know one of the things that the committee does look at is how teams do in those last 10 matches. So it's not only how your season, you know, the overall record, but it's how you do at those last, those last bit of it, too. So that's a dangerous situation.
Yeah, a team like Texas playing very well at the end of the year. I think they deserve some probably a better seeding than perhaps their overall record indicates. But it'll be interesting. We'll have all those questions answered. Brandon, you going to be in front of the television with your team watching the selection show or what?
We are. We've got a little party planned, and it's kind of a fun opportunity where a lot of parents and fans come together. It's neat, you know. You've seen the pictures or you've seen the videos where the teams are, you know, waiting, watching, and the anticipation's kind of, you know, at that point, you know, we're 6 days out. It will be killing us by then. We just want to find out where we're going and then, you know, just kind of have a good time with that.
Will there be boiled peanuts?
I don't know. That's a good question. You know, I'm hosting the team over for Thanksgiving. It's the first ever. We're actually playing this Saturday, and I think I'm going to have to you know, have that as part of the menu for Thanksgiving dinner.
Nice. Always want some boiled peanuts when I'm in Nashville. Hey, I wanted to bring you into the show. I know who's calling now because we just talked about his team playing very well here late in the season. And we're trying to do it. It's our old friend from Nebraska, Eric Sullivan. Welcome to Net Live once again. Eric. 408, you're on the air. That didn't work too well. Reed, are you still with us?
I heard a big click.
I'm with you. I'm with you. That must have been Dan trying to run interference to get Sully off the show.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? People have been sending us some emails. We've had some great response from listeners. And we had one, I think it was this week, came in on the topic that we covered back at the beginning of November. On our November 1st show, we talked about Eric Hinterstock, coach of North Dakota State University, now the former coach, who was forced to resign under duress and under allegations of player abuse, player verbal abuse, and grabbing players. And Geeter and I had a big, long discussion about, is that conduct appropriate? And we talked about swearing at players or at a situation. And I appreciate the fact that Eric Hodgson, the Arizona region from the Arizona region of USA Volleyball, took the time to write us a long letter about that conversation. And I went back and listened to what Geeter and I had to say about swearing in particular as it relates to young athletes. And I think it was taken here in the letter that we received that we had condoned swearing at young athletes. And I don't think that's really what was intended when we were talking. I don't think we condoned it. I think we said it happened. And invariably, you're going to get frustrated. Sometimes it happens. At different levels, it has different consequences. If you're going to be coaching kids who are 7, 8, 9, 10, yeah, that's probably a bigger problem if you're swearing at all, much less on a regular basis. But I think when you get to high school, you get to college, and you have athletes who use profanity themselves, who are certainly exposed to it on a daily basis. I don't want you to use profanity as a coach. I don't want to use profanity as a coach. But it's going to slip out at some point during some circumstance. And I don't think that's a deal killer. Now, if you're doing it all the time, and we talked a lot about Bobby Knight during that show, and the way that he approaches coaching, yelling, screaming, all that kind of stuff. If you're going to do it that way, as a routine daily tool, that's not the approach I want to take. I don't think that's the right approach. And Eric in his email referenced an article on ESPN's Rise by Kirsten Olsen. You can check it out. It's called Balancing It All. Listen to the message, not the tone, when coaches yell, which is an interesting idea, talking about maybe sometimes it takes yelling to get the attention of a player. Maybe sometimes you need to use a swear word to get the attention of a player. And that some players said they responded well to that. And really what I took from this article was, different players respond to different things, and that's really the genius of great coaches is they figure that out. So, Brandon, we have you on the line. Tell us about your approach in the gym and you know, profanity, does it come out, or grabbing girls by the arm or, you know, touching of athletes. Tell us about what has happened within your program.
You know, when I was first started, you know, I was only 25 years old as a head coach. It was just one of those things where I didn't really understand the consequences and what was going on with me swearing and things like that. And after the first year, I just kind of made a rule to myself that it can't go on. I can't do it, and I've got to find different ways. If that's how I have to motivate, then I'm probably not getting the right girls. Or I shouldn't say that. I'm probably not doing the other things right. So I do my very, very best, and I don't know if if my girls have heard me swear, you know, in the midst of them, and it's not anything like I think it's wrong or anything like that. I just think that the perception of it is, you know, all you have to do it is once, and if the wrong person, you know, heard it, it doesn't matter if you only did it once. It's just going to be what everybody knows. And so I determined, hey, that's not what I want. And, you know, we hear it from different players. And, you know, it's – I think you can hold yourself accountable as a coach, you know. And believe me, there's a lot of, you know, times that I have to put the clipboard up in front of my mouth and, you know, sometimes to myself, but not to the players.
Doug Beal infamous for swearing into his hand, although I'm not sure when you swear into your hand at 90 decibels if that really stops.
Maybe it's like the muffler, huh?
Yeah, not sure that makes a difference. Reed, you've played for so many different coaches, both professionally and here in the national team. What's your opinion on the whole thing?
I would say, not that I don't have an opinion, but I just don't see it being extremely important in terms of, I agree with Brandon, if that's the what you're using to motivate, you're not, I don't think you're demanding the right respect that you want out of your players if it's just about yelling and screaming to try to get them to be their best. Obviously, age is going to play a role, and, you know, I don't want my son to be exposed to, you know, stuff like that when it can be controlled. And so, you know, I don't think it's a huge deal, but it's a workplace on a professional level. And in certain offices, it's okay. In certain offices, it's not. And I think it's just kind of per gym. But when we're talking about parents and young kids, then I think it needs to be monitored.
I think it all comes down to situation and context, like you just referenced. And it can't be regular. Certainly, the younger the kids are, the less it should happen. And it can't be the regular course of business. You just can't be that inarticulate about what you're doing. It's definitely going to happen. I know Marv Dunphy is a great coach of mine. I think he swore at me once that I can think of, and I was greatly affected by it as a player. But I know on the bench, he's saying things to coaches privately that have a bit more force behind them, let's say. But Marv is very conscious about what the player needs and what's best for the player to motivate the player. Certainly screaming swear words at a player is not going to motivate them. I want to bring into this conversation also a man who's been on both sides of it. I think we have him now because it's all French fries on the board. Eric Sullivan, former national player, professional player, and now coach for the last, 6 years now, Sully?
This is my seventh season.
Seventh season. So we're talking about swearing at players, a discussion we had back at the beginning of November, as it related to swearing at players and player verbal abuse. There have been a couple of instances of that with coaches around the nation. What's your opinion on the overall use of profanity when it comes to coaching and players?
Whoa, hold on. I thought we were talking about mustaches.
No. I can't get on that conversation, so I got to keep killing it.
No, you know, it's a pretty good topic, and it seems there seems to be a lot of issues going on with it right now, with some coaching changes. And again, I don't know all those situations, but you know, the scuttlebutt is that they were considered verbally abusive, which I would assume probably involves some of that. And you know, I agree with a lot of what you guys have been saying for the last 5 minutes. You know, coaching is very emotional, and in a lot of ways it's a lot more difficult than playing, because a lot of times you have a sense of not having the control that you have when you're playing. Yeah. And you typically, you know, the anxiety that you have before a match, I don't know, at least in my experience, you can kind of hang on to that for the whole match, whereas when you play after about 5 minutes, you kind of play through that stuff. And so there's a lot of emotion and a lot of excitement and a lot of things that are hard to control sometimes on the bench. And, you know, I've got young kids in my house, and so obviously there's, you know, I don't want my kids hearing that stuff. And so, I don't know, the way I behave at home, I try to carry that into the gym. And, again, I don't know that it's the right way, or it's definitely not my way that I use to motivate our players.
I think it's a good point, and we mentioned it in the previous show, talking about coaching is a lot like parenting. It's almost the same equation. How do you want to be perceived? What do you want to give up control of? What do you want to keep control of? How useful are the tools you're using? Because if you use a tool all the time, it becomes less and less effective. Doesn't matter if it's a young adult or a five-year-old. They know how to get under your skin one way or the other, and there's only so many ways to surprise them. But when
sure.
it does happen, I mean, we talk about the stress, and it's going to happen at some point just based on a group of individuals together under stress. Is it something that you should address and own, and can be a learning opportunity for the players to say, look, yeah, I made a mistake. I'm the coach, but I make mistakes too, and you can own it and then move on.
Yeah, you know, I think it's going to depend a lot on the coach's personalities. Like you said, if it's something that you're doing a lot of and you could care less and your players could care less, then maybe that's, you know, your style and everything's good with that and your program. But, you know, I think in coaching, you've got to be strong in your own personality and own it. I mean, if, you know, it's like you said, you're human and you make mistakes. And, you know, I make mistakes all the time, and I have no problems owning that to the players. And, you know, I think that transparency and that kind of relationship is what builds trust and strong bonds. I mean, you know, if you're doing that and then someone else is doing it and you're calling them out, obviously there's going to be some disconnect there. So, you know, we don't want our players doing that stuff in our gym and or, you know, on the court. And, you know, I can't even remember a time where I've had to really kind of get on a kid for doing it. But, yeah, you know, I think and you know, I say all that. I've let it slip sometimes. In heated moments, and, you know, yeah, you own it, and you say, hey, you know, my bad. You know, I was getting a little too emotional. I got to control that, and, you know, let's move on.
The point you make.
Aaron brings up a great point, is that transparency between coach and player. And I think when you're asking players to grow as individuals over their 4 years, that when you can own up to your own mistakes as a coach, it brings so much more validity to the messages that you keep trying to put into them day after day. And, you know, when you do something like that, I think it garners a lot more attention.
It's a longer view for a coach that they need to treat their players as adults, because then you'll end up with adults. And I've been on teams where the players are treated like children, and that's what you end up with. You end up with people are animals. They take the path of least resistance. If you're going to treat me like a child and take away all my responsibility, I'm certainly going to act that way. But if you're going to trust me with responsibility, yeah, there'll be some failures. There'll be some people who can't handle it. But I think overall it'll be better for the group. And you'll grow, and that's when you'll see some of those other things we've talked about, like the center of power moving from the coach and the bench onto the floor. The only way for that to happen is if you, as a coach, release responsibility and show adult respect and appreciation for your players and allow that to develop. You're never going to get it away from you on the bench if you don't treat them as adults and give them those opportunities to fail.
Sure, you know, and that's a great way to think about it. You know, I think the one thing that you got to make sure you're doing when you're doing, or, you know, if you run your program in that manner, is that you got to make sure that you're willing to make the big decisions. You know, are you willing to sit your star athlete when she makes a mistake in a big game? And, you know, possibly put your team at risk for a bad situation. But, you know, you've got to hold true to that. You got to hold true to your morals and just hope that, you know, the rest of all that works itself out.
Certainly not an easy situation for a coach and an easy thing to wrap your head around. But, yeah, a lot of tough decisions certainly based in that. Sully, tell us about your team. You guys are coming off another good week and mentioned as one of the teams that's kind of peaking here towards the end of the season.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty interesting because I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about the Pac-10 and there's a lot of talk about Florida and a lot of talk about Penn State, and I think we're just kind of riding the back burner, which is great. That's fine with us. And, you know, if you look at over our season and our kind of our record and the amount of work that we've done, you know, we were in a 5-game close loss with the number one team in the country. We had a couple swings that we thought we should have killed the ball, and we didn't, and we ended up losing that. And then we lost in 4 with 2 deuce games against a Texas team that was playing really well, and those are our 2 faults. And so, you know, we had a great preseason strength of schedule and the playing in the Big 12, which is a great conference. And, you know, we think we're doing some really nice things. Now, are we that spectacular team that you watch and you look like we're overpowering people and we're doing these phenomenal things? We're definitely not that, and we know that. And that's not our strength. We're a team that's in a great system for what we have. And, you know, night in, night out, we have 1 to 3 or 4 players that step up and take control for matches for us. And it's not the same 3 or 4 players every night. And so that's kind of a nice thing for us. And if we can, you know, show up on a night and get everybody on the same page, it's going to be we're going to be really, really good. Now, we've gone through the month of December without losing a set, and looking around and watching other people play, I don't see that at all. I see a lot of teams kind of battling with some lower-level teams and not kind of rolling. And so we feel pretty good about where we're going and how we're heading into the final week here.
What are your feelings? Go ahead.
I was just going to say we got Baylor at home on Wednesday, and we're at A&M on Saturday. And so, you know, two pretty good teams in the Big 12 probably fighting for their lives right now to even have a shot to get into the tourney.
We talked to a couple of coaches, Mark Rosen and Steve Shondell, on today's show about some of the selection process. We talked to Holly and Dave about it. What's your opinion on the selection process and how it works, rewarding teams that are sometimes five or six deep in their own conference versus teams that are maybe one, number one in their conference, won the regular season, and then didn't do well in the tournament?
Yeah, you know, it's tough. It's tough because, you know, everybody talks about football and basketball and how hard those coaches work. And a coach in a non-revenue-generating sport, we don't work any less. You know, we're just as committed and we're grinding just as hard and we're just as passionate about it. And to work as hard as we do and put in the season that you do and then have a tournament decided based on region and kind of some things that are a little bit unfair is frustrating, and it's frustrating for everybody, I think. So when the selection show occurs, it's kind of this hold your breath and hope things that, you know, work out the way they work out and you get a good path and you're not in a situation that's maybe unfair or overly difficult. But, you know, I think that's just part of the deal, and we all know that. Now, I mean, in saying that, you've got to look at the strength of conferences and how those conferences compete against each other. And, you know, I've never been a big fan of season-ending tournaments. You know, like a lot of the lower-level conferences or mid-level conferences have a season-ending tournament, and that determines the guaranteed spot in the NCAA tournament. To me, you know, you see that situation occur a lot more than you see the other, or maybe you just don't realize it, but you see that occur quite a bit. And to me, yeah, you're discounting the whole body of work from Ball State. I mean, they've, you know, I mean, looking at the RPIs, it looks like Ball State's in a good position and they're going to get in. And so maybe that helps their conference out at the end of the day and they get two teams in. But, you know, you're discounting what they did all season, and what they did all season was dominate their conference. And they show up and have a bad night, and, you know, in volleyball, and especially right now, there's so much parity. Anybody can beat anybody any night. And, you know, maybe there's some unforeseen circumstances in some of those. You have an injury or a sickness, or maybe you're just not on. But, you know, all of a sudden, we just played for 3.5 months, and it really doesn't mean all that much. And so I think you're seeing a lot more conferences go away from that tournament schedule and just start to rely on the season as their automatic bid.
If you're going to force teams to play against their conference, then you're hamstringing them. You can't. They can't do anything else but play their own conference. So you're going to have to give them some advantage if you're going to force them to schedule those other teams twice.
Sure, but you know, I think part of that too is as a head coach, I think you've got to realize where you're at and what conference you're in, and then schedule around that. You know, if I was in a mid-level conference, and I haven't been, I've only coached in the Big 12, and nor have I been in the position to make those decisions ultimately. But you know, I think in those conferences, you got to go out and schedule a really difficult preseason, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what your record is. You've got to win your conference tournament. And so there's no reason that you shouldn't be out trying to improve your RPI in the 3 weeks before your season so that you get the best competition and challenge your team. And then, you know, if you're, you know, 15-9 or 15-12 or whatever, and you win your tournament, you're still going to the NCAAs, you know. And if you're not winning your tournament, then it doesn't really matter what your record is sometimes.
Very good, Sully. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, no problems, man. I appreciate it.
All right, we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, always good. See you guys.
Bye. All right, Eric Sullivan from Nebraska. Gentlemen, Reed, we got 2 minutes. Brandon, we got 2 minutes. Been another good episode. Thoughts, reflections?
You know, I think one of the things that Sullivan brings up is the parity. And I think as there becomes more and more parity in women's collegiate volleyball, the NCAA needs to look at that more and reward that more. Just because, you know, conferences haven't been able to, you know, produce more than one team in the past, you know, I think that's it's a bad path to go down, because I think, you know, Sullivan's right. There is so much more parity that, you know, people need to look at that.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Gentlemen, thanks for being on.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Kevin.
Been a good show. We've enjoyed having you here. We talked a lot of college this week. It's going to be a little more next week as the tournament comes up. It's been fun on the Net Live. I'm Kevin, your host. Next week, Geeter's back. Got a lot of good topics coming up. Hopefully, Reed will be there. Reed, congratulations, hanging on for 95% of the show with your Russian internet. That was good.
I feel good about it.
Sorry to Alex Kelly. We'll get her on. We'll get you a bonus interview, Alex. My apologies. It's been fun. The Net Live on the volleyballnetwork.com. Thanks a lot. See ya.